Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, of the making of books, there is no end. How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Well, hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, I have one short comment to read today, and then I will have a longer one to read on the next program. But this is, Dear JBL, very much enjoying learning about Lawrence of Arabia. Thanks so much. Keep up the great work. So I really like comments like that. I could get 100 of those a day, and that would make me feel really good. So, as I said in the last several programs, if you have not started reading Hero, don't miss this opportunity. It really is a fascinating and a thrilling book. Well, today, what I want to do is I want to keep our focus in Chapter 1, and I think the title of Chapter 1 is fantastic. Who is this extraordinary pipsqueak? So let me just recap a little bit for you, and to kind of bring you up to speed where we are if you're just listening in for the first time. So I think let's get the big overall picture. Remember that the that the British were very much in favor of inspiring an Arab revolt against the Ottoman Empire. And remember, the reason they wanted to do this is they were at war with the Germans in World War I. And Britain and France actually were working together to inspire this Arab revolt against the Ottoman Empire. And, of course, the Ottoman Empire used to really expand over all of the Middle East, and now essentially it's been boiled down to just the nation of Turkey today. And so it was very different. Now, when the leaders of the Ottoman Empire, there were some problems with Russia and other things, and they joined with the Germans. What we have to remember, too, is there was intense Arab interest in throwing off the rule of the Turks. And so I don't think the Arabs certainly wanted Germany in the Middle East. And also the British did not want the Germans in the Middle East. And so there was kind of a marriage of ideas there. But many Arabs had dreamed of an Arab empire with Damascus as its capital. And so this was a big dream. I mean, again, as I said in other programs, the Turks were part of, Jacob's brother Esau. And, of course, Esau had married several of the Ishmaelite women, and of course that comes from Ishmael or Abraham's son with Hagar. So they were Arabic peoples, but they were from different, patriarchs. So the British definitely did not want the Germans in the Middle East, because that would have given them access to those overflowing oil supplies, and also it would have given Germany access or maybe even control of the very important and strategic Suez Canal. And so that's the big overview. And let me just read to you what was going on. There had been conflict between the Arabs and, the Turks, and the British were involved as well. And things were not going so well. And Korda tells us this on page 21 of chapter 1. And things were really going pretty badly for the Arabs and also for the British. The British did not seem to be really well organized. And there was also some other problems. And just trying to join the British mind with an Arabic mind and unite them together, that was not going so well as either. So here's what Korda writes. This is on page 21. He says, "For all that, the war in the Middle East was going badly." Of course, we also know it was going badly in France as well. He said, "Attempts by the British to break through the Turkish line at Gaza had failed. The Arabs' attempt to take Medina had led merely to a protracted and humiliating defeat. and the Arabs' hostility toward any European presence inland meant that nobody in Cairo had a clear picture of just what Faisal's men were doing or what was taking place in the vast, empty desert beyond the few small ports on the Red Sea in the possession of the Allies. And so here was a very challenging war. It was a non-European war, and it was a war in the desert. And so it just is amazing. Along comes T.E. Lawrence. And it's really kind of fascinating how this all came about. But remember, T.E. Lawrence was brought in to the British military because of his vast, he had this vast knowledge of the Arabic mind and culture, and he had an amazing understanding of Middle East geography or topography. And remember how he gained all this. He had been an archaeology student, and he was on that world-famous dig at Carchemish, which was the location of the ruins of the ancient biblical Hittites. And that was a big deal when that came out in, let's say, in the field of archaeology, that they began to unearth all these things at Carchemish. Now, remember, he was an Oxford archaeology student, and so he was there on loan from Oxford. And even with our programs here at the college, our students do go to Jerusalem on archaeology projects. They can travel in other parts of the Middle East as well, and certainly we send them let them see the safest places around that area. But essentially, what Lawrence did as a young student, he toured through the Middle East. He had become an expert map maker. He also learned Arabic, and he really had an appreciation of the Arabic culture. And so all those things were like getting him prepared to do what needed to be done to really inspire this Arab revolt against the Turks. Now, as we get into the book, even in chapter one, you're really taken into the middle of the story in many ways. And as I said in a previous program, it's a little hard sometimes for us to grasp what's going on, but we have to get the background. We really have to understand what's going on. And so as Michael Korda opens up this chapter, he takes us immediately into Lawrence's understanding of how to organize the Arabs to revolt successfully against the Turks. And again, you have to get some background. I know, as I told you before, I had to go and study what the Ottoman Empire was. And of course, I knew about the Ottoman Empire, but it seemed like that was really ancient history. And obviously, 1900s can seem like ancient history to us, but the Ottoman Empire goes back a lot further than that. But anyway, Lawrence just had this ability to size up a situation. And of course, we also need to understand a little bit about the Prophet Muhammad, I think, how he organized the tribes when he was alive. And so what Lawrence did, he knew some of this history. He knew the Arabic mind. He knew the Arabic culture. And he approached, his commanders that the best thing that they could do was to find an Arabic prophet. This is a man that could unite the Arabic tribes. And these Arabic tribes, they were so plagued by violent and murderous infighting. That's just a weakness in their nature. And if you have these different tribes, and if you insult another tribe, then there's blood feuds that go on, and they could go on for generations. And they're almost like the Irish. Irish people can hold a grudge. Well, so can the Arabs. And so anyway. But that was unique. I mean, we have to understand how unique that was. That T.E. Lawrence just comes on the scene, and he's really pretty young. And we're going to talk about that today, how young he actually was. But essentially, that plan was really, really favorable to the British. And if you understand the other side of World War One. You know, the millions of young men were getting slaughtered in the trenches in France from the Germans. So the British were very favorable to having a plan where they didn't have to, you know, add a lot of troops. And T.E. Lawrence also knew that they needed guns, and they needed equipment, they needed supplies. So the British were really willing to do that. Now, the Arabs were also somewhat accepting of his plan, although they did want the British troops. They felt like they needed the British troops. But the Arabs knew they were not organized fighters, and that they thought, well, any time they lost a battle, when they lost Medina, they wanted more British troops. Of course, they wanted more guns and things like that. But still, if you look at the cultural situation, the Arabic peoples, because of their religion and, you know, because of really looking at Christian Europeans as infidels, that was not a marriage that was easy to make. And so Lawrence was smart enough to say, hey, we need to find an Arab leader or an Arab prophet who actually could, you know, pull this together. And so essentially what he does is he makes his target the sons of the Sharif of Mecca. Now, of course, this was Sharif Hussein. And but I don't know how many people know that, the Sharif Hussein was actually a descendant of Muhammad's grandson. And so he targets right to where, like, the same family of the Prophet Muhammad. So essentially, as the book opens, he decides he needs to see Sharif's sons. Of course, at the port of Jeddah, he eliminates Amir Abdullah because he's just not the right, you know, the right fighter. He goes into his tent and it's all full of nice things, and so he's not really the fighting type. And the Sharif of Mecca, or Sharif Hussein, has other sons. They're in the Hejaz. And so I actually was saying that quite right. I did go after that last program. I did go back and make sure I could pronounce Hejaz right, and that's how you say it. So it is H-E-J-A-Z. That is the Holy Kingdom, or it's the Holy Shrines that includes Mecca and Medina. And so the rest of Sharif's sons were in there, and they had to get special permission for him to go into the Hejaz because he's a Christian soldier, and his life was very, very threatened. He's non-Arabic. He's a Christian. He was considered an infidel. And, of course, you know, that was really not good for, T.E. Lawrence to get caught like that. So I think that's the necessary background we need. But I thought maybe we could just open up today's program. I want to just take you to page 6. And there's a reason why I'm doing this is we have to realize that even Lawrence, let's say, didn't necessarily mesh with his commanders very well. And he was quirky. I think I talked about this a couple programs ago, but I thought it might be good to remind you of this. And there's a reason. I'll talk to you why I'm bringing this up in just a little bit. And if I don't get to it this program, I'll definitely do it next program. So the important thing is, there's a lot more to Lawrence than you would kind of meet the eye. And there's a reason why. And sometimes really smart people and really geniuses don't really seem to fit in like with the rest of us, or they don't seem normal. And so here's what Korda writes about him. He says, neither his sense of humor nor his unmistakable air of intellectual superiority appealed for the more conventional spirits. In his short stature, he was 5 feet 5 inches tall, and a head that seemed disproportionately large for his body and unruly blonde hair set him apart from fellow junior officers. One of his companions on the trip behind Turkish lines described him as an odd gnome, half cad with a touch of genius. And a superior at headquarters in Cairo may have summed up the general opinion there of Lawrence when he asked, "Who is this extraordinary pipsqueak?" And so I think I read part of that to you before. But he was really quirky, and he could even wear a soldier's uniform without looking weird. I mean, that's basically it. And Michael Korda goes on and says, "Those who judged him by his quirky manner and his ill-fitting, wrinkled, off-the-rack uniform, the cuffs of his trousers always 2 or 3 inches above his boots, the badge sometimes missing from his pea cap, Lawrence did not cut a soldierly figure, so most of them failed to notice the intense ice-blue eyes and unusually long, firm, determined jaw, a facial structure more Celtic than English. It was the face of a non-religious ascetic, capable of enduring hardship and pain beyond what most men would even want to contemplate, a true believer in other people's causes, a curious combination of scholar and man of action, and most important of all, a dreamer." And so the thing is, T. Lawrence was more than a quirky character. He actually was a leader of men. He actually was a hero. And one of the things that I think we need to really focus on about Lawrence is he was an expert on Warcraft. Now, again, we tend to focus on the idea of him being an archaeologist and being all that. But one of the things we have to understand about him is he really had this passion for military history. And, you know, he developed that actually at Oxford as well. And he did study a lot of the medieval castles in Europe, but he also studied them in the Middle East. And if you remember from the Crusades, a lot of even the kings of England would go to the Middle East, and they wanted to rescue Jerusalem from the Turks or from, the Arabs. They wanted that area of Jerusalem to stay in, Christian hands. And so they would build castles, and they would build forts, and they would fortify themselves. And so this is what he was really fascinated with. I'm going to just read you now from page 27 of, just chapter 1. And this chapter 1, you really need to study it and maybe even reread it. I know I've had to reread several pages over again to understand what's really being said here. But here's what Korda records for us. It says, "Adding to Lawrence's vast store of knowledge was his long-standing passion for military history, tactics, and strategy. Castles had fascinated him since childhood, and as a boy he had visited, sketched, and measured the remains of most of the great castles in Britain and France. Traveling phenomenally distances by bicycle, as an undergraduate at Oxford, he visited the great Crusader castles of the Near East, and indeed his thesis at Oxford, which won him first, so brilliant a success that his tutor at Jesus College gave a lavish dinner to the examiners to celebrate it, was," and here's the title of his final thesis, "The Influence of the Crusades on European Military Architecture to the End of the 12th Century, with maps, architectural plans, and photographs by himself." And what Korda goes on to say is this actually was published as a book, and I've actually looked for it online. I found a copy of it, but it's really expensive. So I don't know. I have to really think about whether I want to get that book or not. But the point is, He studied a lot about history. And the one thing I think we don't want to forget about Lawrence is that he never did things in like by half, as Korda would say, or I can't say it on the radio, but my father had a way of telling me when I didn't do a job well enough. But anyway, he didn't do anything by half. He did everything to the full. So you can see that this thesis at Oxford was probably brilliant. And I did get to look a little bit at the cover of the book, and it does show a lot of his maps and things that he designed. And so it really was really does look like a fascinating book. I'll have to see if I can save my pennies to get it. Now, Korda goes on to say his interest in medieval fortifications and armor led him naturally to a broader study of military thinking. His friend and biographer in later life, the distinguished British military historian and philosopher B.H. Little Hart, would praise Lawrence's astonishingly wide reading of military texts. That reading began when Lawrence was only 15, what he himself dismissed as schoolboy stuff. And again, here's a list of books that Lawrence considered schoolboy stuff. And to be honest, I've never heard of it. You probably haven't either. Creasy's 15 Decisive Battles of the World, Napier's History of the War in the Peninsula, Cox's Marlborough, Mahan's Influence of Sea Power on History, Henderson's Stonewall Jackson. And so he was reading these books at 15. And he sounds a little bit like Jude Fleury to me. We've had Jude Fleury on here. He's reading all these, you know, these books. Now, it's interesting that Hart actually compared Lawrence to Napoleon. And I know that they're reading Napoleon the Great at the book club in Edstone, at our campus in Edstone. And one thing that that we all know about Napoleon is that he studied military history. He studied the great generals. He studied these great battles. And we also know the same thing of Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill studied history, and he studied about war, and he studied about battles. And, of course, his most famous, you know, great, I don't know how many great-grandfathers was Marlborough. So he came from a military, you know, background. And, of course, here's what, let's say, a young boy, here this 5'5", blonde-haired pipsqueak, loved history. And he loved history of the military accomplishment. And so essentially, you know, even though he was weird and a little quirky, and even though he disrespected, you know, his commanders, what they began to realize is that they had this budding genius, or this budding military genius, in their midst. And here it was in the body of Second Lieutenant and Acting Staff Captain T.E. Lawrence. And so when he got, you know, into the military, he excelled in terms of his mind and his way of seeing things, and the way he did things is incredible. And so again, he studied military history. Now, if you remember the last program, or maybe the last two, I'm losing track on these programs, but he loved geography. And the thing that's important is what really helped the war effort because of that is you really need geography. You need to understand geography to plan military victories. And, of course, Lawrence knew how to do this. This is what I'm just going to read a little bit more of Korda to you about, you know, not only his genius but about how he used geography. It says, Korda says at the top of page 29, the generals in Cairo may be forgiven for not noticing they had a budding military genius in their midst in the person of temporary second lieutenant and acting staff captain T.E. Lawrence. But even before the war, he had begun consciously to develop a kind of sideline to archaeology and literature what Napoleon called le coup de wheel de genie. He said, the rare and elusive quick glance of genius that enables a great commander to see at once on a map or from the landscape in front of him the point at which an enemy is weakest and where an attack will throw the enemy off balance. And essentially what Korda says then is years of studying Castle had given Lawrence an instinctive feel for topography. It was no accident that he had entered the army through the back door of a mapmaker, and a real gift for visualizing how geographical features determine the movement of armed forces and inexorably govern both attack and defense. And so he had this incredible skill. Now, I want to just focus on this one paragraph, and it's really important. It's also on page 29. This is talking about Lawrence's ability to think. says his ability to think in three dimensions, his keen eye for even the smallest details of the landscape, and his remarkable visual memory were all formidable assets for a soldier, though as yet untested in battle. So essentially, he goes on to say, it's geography that determines strategy, and certainly Napoleon understood that. So essentially, Lawrence could think in three dimensions. I can hardly think in one dimension. So if you can imagine that. But anyway, he then decides that he's going to be the one to find this Arab prophet. And I just want to let you know that we're out of time for today's program. I'm not surprised. This is so exciting. So that's all we have time for today. Next time, I will continue my discussion of, let's say, Lawrence's search for the prophet. And so for this current series, remember, we are using Michael Korda's book, Hero, The Life and Legend of Lawrence of Arabia. You can buy this book at Amazon.com. You can find a used copy of the book at abebooks.com. And, of course, you can also check your local library. So please write me any comments you may have to JBL at PCOG.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at JBLiterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. And so, until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.